Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Reclaimed. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So nice we did it twice. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. And the premise of this podcast is we are exploring our streaming services. We have access to a bunch. Most people do.
Yeah, at least a couple.
That's the way most people seem to be consuming their films these days.
That's just life.
And we started this habit when lockdown began during the pandemic. Rather than just review the new films, we wanted to explore what was available to us. And we still want to explore what's available to us.
Yeah, we want to look at the older movies that sometimes get overlooked on streaming services. And in the case of Whitney and I, who are avid cinephiles, no matter how many movies we've seen, we've never seen everything. Mm. And so we can use this as an opportunity to fill in the gaps in our own knowledge and so that we can see a classic movie or at least a cult movie or a well-known movie or a significant film of some kind for the first time. And we can do it at the behest of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Every time we do an episode, we put up a poll and our patrons. Is a real word. Patrons, yeah. Is not. Our patrons get to decide which film we're going to watch. We pick a streaming service and a category. Bada bing. This time we were looking at films in the Turner Classic Movies section on HBO Max, which I must say is a pretty respectable selection of older films.
It's HBO Max has been pretty good because HBO is part of the Time Warner. Conglomerate.
Enclave. Magnate. Armada.
Quincunox.
The Bene Gesserit.
But they're also in charge of Turner Classic Movies. They're also have a pretty solid tie into the Criterion Channel.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have HBO, you do have access to a lot of notable classic and international films.
Mm-hmm. It's still not quite as good as maybe the best video store you could find back in the heyday. For a streaming service, very respectable.
As streaming services tend to go, yes. Mm-hmm. Look for a classic movie on Hulu, you'll be SOL.
Yeah, look for a classic movie on Netflix, you'll find like a couple.
Yeah, there's three or four.
Plenty to choose from on HBO
and
Max.
Disney Plus is...
Well, they only got the Disney stuff.
It's only the Disney stuff, but they also own the Fox library.
Yeah.
But where are all the classic Fox films?
They're trying to figure that out, apparently.
Back in the 30s and 40s.
They're still trying to figure out where that's supposed to go.
Yeah, is that going to Disney Plus. Or Hulu, at least.
You own Hulu, too, Disney. Just pick one.
Put them all out
there. Apparently,
outside
of America, Disney Plus has, like a different like sort of branch that is like all these other non-family friendly movies.
Fine, like, do that here.
Do it here. Who cares, man? Just give us the damn movies. We want them. Anyway,
I don't care what their thinking is. I care what my thinking is.
In any case, we ran a poll, and the winner of the poll, which I'm pleasantly surprised, I didn't know if you'd go for this one, is a classic John Huston film noir, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Edward G. Robinson and Lionel Barrymore. And it is a little film called Key Largo, Montego, Baby, Why Don't We Go? Oh, no. Off the Key Largo Keys, there's a place called Key Largo. That's where we're gonna go to get kidnapped by Edward G. Robinson. Humphrey Bogart will try to stop him, and Lauren Bacall will be there too.
You can't
Lionel Barrymore is a good
hear
actor.
My despair,
and
but I assure you it's there. Key Largo is
gonna kill me.
Key Largo is a film 1948. It's the fourth and final film that Bogie and Bacall made together.
Mm-hmm.
They were notoriously paired together in Dark Passage, To Have It Have Not, this one, and
The Big Sleep. Yep.
I almost named them all.
Yeah, I don't think that's the correct order, but that's about it. But those are the four films.
Those are the four films they made together.
Yeah, and they smoldered, people loved them together, they were lovers in real life. Enormous age difference, by the way,
oh, yeah.
But
she,
whatever.
She was quite a bit younger than he.
Mm-hmm.
And Humphrey Bogart is playing the Humphrey Bogart role. Yeah. He didn't have a huge amount of range as an actor.
Oh, I think that's a little unfair. I think he got typecast as a tough guy.
Maybe that's a little bit fairer.
If you look at Humphrey Bogart, if you don't know Humphrey Bogart very well, you probably know him at least as an archetype. He had a very long face. He never looked young. Even in his youngest movies, he was at least 40. He just carried, like, it looked like he'd been through some shit. That was the beauty of Humphrey Bogart. He wore a long life on his face. He had a very... what are you doing here?
Sorry.
He's got a very kind of a craggy voice. Sounds like he smokes a lot of cigarettes. You're dead. He often played a lot of tough guys. However, when he was cast outside of that, he was always very good. Look at him in something like Sabrina with Audrey Hepburn and William Holden. He's very funny in that. He knows the role he's playing.
Yeah, but again, in that one, he played sort of a similar Stern type of character. Well, one who's softened by the end.
Well, look at African Queen, where he's kind of adult.
That's a little bit of a change for kinds of roles he was
doing. It's a little overly simplistic to say he didn't have range. I think he just had a type, got cast that way, and he played it.
I take back my flip all statement about the career of Humphrey Bogart.
All right. I'm a fan.
I am too.
I know. I'm
just trying to be descriptive, not critical.
Accuracy is what I want.
And in this one, he plays an ex-soldier who is returning to Key Largo, one of the Florida Keys.
Mm-hmm. Little islands off the coast of Florida. If you ever saw True Lies, you know, there's that big, like, car chase over, like, these giant concrete freeways.
Spectacular bridge explosion at the end of that movie.
Awesome action sequence, but, like, that's, like, the opening shot of this movie. It's just a car driving on there to get to a small island.
He is going to be visiting the father of a fallen comrade.
Yeah. Right after World War II.
Who died in the war. And he's going to meet his father and his comrade's widow.
Yeah. His comrade's father is played by the great Lionel Barrymore. Mm. One of the great actors, just period. In the later part of his life, he had really bad arthritis and he was confined to a wheelchair. But he kept acting, damn it. And you can see him in It's a Wonderful Life. Key Largo, filmed around the same time. Just still vital and amazing. And Lauren Bacall plays the widow, who... is surprisingly reserved, I think, in this film. She's very, it's a quiet performance, in a way
quiet performance, and none of it is informed by the loss of her husband. It seems like she's already kind of at the acceptance phase of her grieving.
Yeah.
So she's not, like, super demonstrative in her emotions.
Yeah.
Who is demonstrative is the small pack of lowlives who are hanging out in the hotel that Lionel Barrymore runs.
Yeah, this hotel is ostensibly a tourist trap, but Key Largo can be, like, almost unbearably hot a lot of the year, so they don't have a lot of tenants right now. But someone came along and said, we want to rent out the entire hotel.
It's off season, and the storm is approaching.
Yeah, hurricane. And so someone came in and said, I want to rent out the entire hotel, and Lionel Barrymore couldn't turn down that kind of money in the off season. So the entire hotel has been rented out to scum, basically.
Yeah, there's
just scummy lowlife assholes.
In fact, the opening scene is Humphrey Bogart goes into the hotel bar and says, hey, I'd like a drink. And the bartender, a complete dick, says, no. Are you sure I can't have a drink? No. It's like Charles Grodin and Sarah Married an Axe Murder. No. Sure I can't have a drink? No.
So you
and
got
the drunken gambler at the end of the bar says, buy him a drink. She's my favorite character.
Yeah, she's played by Claire Trevor. Claire Trevor is a wonderful actor. Claire Trevor won an Academy Award for this. It's the only nomination this film got. Which is a little surprising if you think about it. It's quite a good film. It's got an amazing cast. Claire Trevor was nominated. Claire Trevor won. I'm trying to think, what do people know Claire Trevor best from nowadays? She was in Stagecoach. She was in Dead End, another Humphrey Bogart movie. Great movie. If you've never seen Dead End, do not miss it. It's a fantastically stylish and gritty noir class struggle kind of film.
I'm not sure if you could even call it a noir.
Well, it's a proto-noir. Yeah, noir hadn't really been codified as a genre yet, but it's about a dead end street in New York City. And there's a lot of impoverished people there, a lot of latchkey kids. Also a lot of criminals, and also a lot of people who would very much like to move out of that town if they could afford to. they can't. And also, right next to that town, a really fancy building filled with rich people, like just right there looking down on them all. And in this little microcosm of New York City, a whole bunch of bad shit happens, mostly spearheaded by Humphrey Bogart, who plays a murderer who has come back into his hometown to clean up old business.
But his isn't like the main story. There's actually like several stories going on in Dead End, and for which... Claire Trevor was nominated for an Academy Award for that one, for Dead End as well.
Greg Toland, who also did Citizen Kane, he was a cinematographer, and he was a cinematographer for Dead End. Dead End looks amazing. Dead End would win an Academy Award for Best Cinematography now. Like, it's a really good-looking film. People do not talk about it enough. I'm a huge fan. We discovered it when we... discovered it's an exaggerated term, but it's not talked about enough, and we made a point of seeing it for our podcast, only the best review, every Best Picture nominee, and boy, was that a great discovery on that podcast, so we want everyone to see that.
Claire Trevor has the most going on emotionally in this story.
Oh, yeah.
This is like a potboiler thriller where there's just a lot of slow burn and tension, and she's the one who kind of is going through an arc that's a little less motivated by the plot.
Yeah. She'd have an interesting story even if none of the action happened.
Exactly. Yeah. She's turned to drink, and we'll learn later that she was once a gangster's moll, and during the course of the movie, she'll learn how the gangster really felt about her all of these years, and it's not kind, and she has this sort of emotional breakdown.
Yeah.
So she actually has, like, a lot of life and vivacity, and she's really interesting, and... she is hurt very, very deeply, and we get to see how that affects her. She's a great character. I don't feel the same way about the Lauren Bacall character, who seems to be, like most of the characters, swept up in the plot. The plot is there are some fugitives on the run, and the sheriff is looking after them. And the hotel is all booked up with all these lowlifes, and there's a mysterious tenant that we won't see for a little bit. That mysterious tenant, once the cop is gone, we learn is Edward G. Robinson, who is playing a gangster whose career ended when Prohibition ended. He used to be, like, high on the hog, and there's numerous speeches to the effect of, people used to listen to me. And he's trying to get... back into the world of crime with some sort of, it's not a drug deal, but it's sort of counterfeit money. Oh, it's counterfeit money.
It's a MacGuffin. It doesn't matter what it is. He's got a big deal going down, but it turns out it's
he needs
money
to fulfill this criminal enterprise while he's staying at this hotel.
Yeah.
And when it's revealed who he is and what he's up to, he essentially takes everybody hostage and says, you can't tell the cops and I'm here. And it becomes sweatier and sweatier in that hotel. It was based on a play, so it all feels very theatrical throughout the middle section where everybody's just sort of trapped in a room.
Yeah, the play was set during the Spanish Civil War. They completely changed it.
Oh, gosh.
They took a war story and decided to make it a modern-day gangster film.
Yeah.
Edward G. Robinson is basically playing a version of Al Capone.
Yeah.
Al Capone, of course, ruled the roost during the Prohibition era. You want to see a great movie about Al Capone? See The Untouchables. You want to see an accurate movie about Al Capone? Don't see The Untouchables.
Look, The Untouchables is a corker.
It's like it's cinematic joy. Just absolute genius from start to finish. It is historically inaccurate as hell, but I don't think it's pretending to be anything but. Anyway... Edward G. Robinson plays this gangster, and it takes a long time. All we know is that there's a guy in a room over there. We don't see that guy.
Yeah.
We see all of his goons, played by some really great actors. Thomas Gomez, Spanish-American actor, was nominated for an Academy Award for the unfortunately named film noir Ride the Pink Horse.
Oh my God.
It's not a good title. Context of the film, it's a stupid title. It's not a good... I'm not a huge fan of the film. Thomas Gomez is really good in that.
That's even unfortunate for a pickup line.
Right? Like, there's nothing good about that. Why was that fun? Anyway, thank God it's in black and white. You got Thomas Gomez in there. You got Harry Lewis as the very well-dressed guy with, like, a hair trigger temper. You know he's going to kill everybody, and he's a total dick. We just keep hearing about him. Here's this guy. He's going to show up. And then when he finally shows up, it's Edward G. Robinson.
In the
naked,
bath. Yeah.
Naked in a bathtub. It's covered in luxurious chest hair. And
smoking a cigar.
Smoking a cigar.
While he's in the tub.
Puts on a nice robe. and then just walks out and says hi to everybody. And then just Edward G. Robinson, not a tall man, not a particularly like gigantic, imposing physical presence, but he was such a great actor and he had such great presence that as soon as he walks in, everybody, Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, Lionel Barrymore, Thomas Gomez, everyone else is just like, oh shit, we better sit down. Edward G. Robinson's here.
He's a wonderful actor. He had a very caricaturizable face. Yes. You saw him in a lot of cartoons.
A lot of Looney Tunes. He made fun of him.
Sort of a wide mouth and sort of an angled brow. He just had a really wonderful face.
Had a great delivery. Anytime you hear someone say, yeah, see, yeah, they're doing Edward G. Robinson.
Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah.
Another actor who is typecast a lot. He's best known for his gangster roles. Mm-hmm. He did, I think, have a good deal of rage. I've seen him play like kind of gentle characters.
Did you ever see Scarlet Street?
I think I have.
He plays a very gentle man who's just in a kind of a crappy loveless marriage, and he meets like a woman who he thinks is very sweet, and he ends up destroying his entire life to like because she makes him feel young again, and she knows she's taking advantage of him the whole time. Mm. It's just this incredibly bitter, sad movie. But Edward G. Robinson is next level good. Like I think it's his best performance I've ever seen.
And here he's playing a gangster role, one of the ones he's better known for, I'd say, and. Over the course of the film, it's them just sort of waiting for this criminal enterprise to go down. And while they're doing so, they're playing these weird psychological head games with each other.
Yeah.
To no particular end other than to break each other down.
Yeah.
Humphrey Bogart kind of, at the beginning of the film, he's like, he's a lot like Rick from Casablanca, and that he doesn't really care about sticking his neck out anymore.
He went to war. He fought his war. He's done with his war. The one bit of character business that we know about him, because he doesn't talk about himself a lot. He spends most of his time talking about his fallen comrade, because he's gone to see his family, and they want to know, tell me what happened. And he tells them a story about this, how he heroically, stayed up for like 48 hours to defend a position. And after he gives this great speech, to which Lionel Barrymore is very grateful, he feels really full of pride in his son. Like a scene later, Lauren Bacall says, before he died, my husband told me that story, and he said, you did that. So that's what we know about Humphrey Bogart. He's heroic, but he has absolutely no interest in self-aggrandizement, in glory. He doesn't want any of that. He's actually very, very eager just for a simple life again. So when he's thrown into a life or death situation, especially with other hostages, this is a big hostage movie. Everyone's a hostage. He's not going to pull a Die Hard. Like, this is Die Hard if, like, John McClane wasn't around. Basically, if there was a guy like lurking about just every once in a while pulling someone out and killing everybody, this is Die Hard. But you don't have that, so it's just about it's just about all those other. It's just about Bonnie Bedelia trying to save the day.
I was gonna say it's about Mr. Nakatomi.
Sure.
Who's like
Lionel Barrymore is Mr. Nakatomi. Bonnie Bedelia is Lauren Bacall. I
would think Humphrey Bogart is Mr. Nakatomi, the one who's like trying to talk to the bad guys. He meets a bad end in that movie, but he's the one who actually has a little bit of control of the situation.
I can just imagine like Humphrey Bogart go like, Hans, Bobby.
So you're trying to stage Humphrey Bogart as Ellis?
If Ellis didn't do coke and actually learned some valuable lessons in World War II, or I don't know, what would Ellis have been in? He's too young for Vietnam, even. I don't know. Anyway, if Ellis had seen, if Ellen had been in like the Falklands, like he'd seen some shit, and that's a big character development. That's what the story is. My timing might be off even on the Falklands. I'm not
going
to lie.
This analogy doesn't quite work, but
it doesn't
see
work.
I see what you're getting at here. Over the course of the film, Humphrey Bogart goes from this character who is not... Let me look at the Humphrey Bogart's name.
He's played Major Frank McCloud.
Frank is his character's name.
Yeah. Edward G. Robinson plays Johnny Rocco.
Johnny Rocco, a.k.a. Rocco. Like, they just call him Rocco.
Yeah, and it's like... And it's again, it's this great... technique, and Orson Welles talked about this a lot when he did The Third Man, is that the greatest gift he had in The Third Man was...
Everybody's talking about
his character. The first half of the movie is just people talking about his character and building him up. So when he shows up in an alleyway, he's just standing there. But you gasp. Because, oh, shit, it's Harry Lime. Holy fuck. Like, you're just like, it's been built up so much. Johnny Rocco gets built up a lot. People talk about him so much. A lot of the work is already done for Edward G. Robinson. And yet he still brings it.
I forgot which play it was, but in the Criterion introduction to The Third Man, Peter Bogdanovich tells a story of...
Mr. Lee is coming.
It was Mr. Lee, I think was the name of the character. Yeah. And the entire first half was everybody's talking about Mr. Lee. And all we saw of Mr. Lee was on stage there was a bridge, and we saw the actor like cross the bridge. No lines.
Yeah.
Not even up, not even downstage where people could see him. He's just there in the back.
Yeah.
And Peter Bogdanovich recalls like people at intermission saying, "And Mr. Lee would give such a good performance. I can't wait to see more." Mr. Lee did nothing.
Yeah, it's a gift.
The character was built without the actor having to do anything.
If you can have that kind of introduction as an actor, you've been given the best gift in the world. That's basically what Edward G. Robinson gets here.
Has that ever been a letdown to you? Like where there's a character everybody's talking about, and when they finally show up, it's like, oh, it's just...
Well, it's been a joke before. Like I think about Spy Kids 3D is a good example of this, where they talk about, because they're all stuck in like this video game, and there are other people who are playing the video game that are trapped in this virtual reality, and one of whom is a guy they've talked about is supposedly the best gamer in the world, the guy.
Oh, yeah.
He's the guy. And when they finally, just all of a sudden, he shows up, and it's Elijah Wood, and he's like in this incredible, awesome suit of power armor, and like he's gonna save the day, and then he just runs in to save the day and immediately dies.
Hmm.
I've seen it subverted. I'm trying to think if I've ever seen it just done really, really badly. I'm being honest, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. I'll think about it more if I come up with it over this.
There's got to be like some romance where somebody's pining for somebody and they finally show up and they're just, you know, an uninteresting character.
Well, again, it's been done on purpose. Mm-hmm. Here's a good one. You ever see Only You with Marissa Tomei?
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Marissa Tomei plays a girl who, when she was a little kid, she and a friend of hers went to see a fortune teller at like a carnival or something. I haven't seen it in a long time. I forget the exact context, but they go to see a fortune teller. And the fortune teller, she says, "Who will I marry?" She's a very romantic young girl. And I want to get it right. Hang on, let's say. Let me get the name right here. 1994. okay. This 11-year-old girl, it's a Ouija board, sorry. A Ouija board tells her that she will fall in love with someone named Damon Bradley. And then later on, a fortune teller says, "You will fall in love with someone named Damon Bradley." Now she's a grown woman, she's mostly put this aside, and she's about to marry some normal dude. But then she finds out that there's a guy named Damon Bradley in, like, Rome, so she, like, absconds to Europe to find this guy, and she finds Robert Downey Jr., and he says his name is Damon Bradley, and they have this incredible whirlwind romance, but then it turns out he's not named Damon Bradley, he just thought she was really interesting and knew that she would only talk to him if his name was Damon Bradley, because he overheard her. And then when she finally meets a guy named Damon Bradley, he's like just sort of fine. It's like, oh, he seemed cool. Anyway, that's 1994 Robert Downey Jr., so I'm going to go do that.
Well, and I'm 1994 Marissa Tomei, so sure.
There's a podcast called Bad Romance, where I think they were reviewing this film, and they described Robert Downey Jr.'s 90s hair in the most perfect two words. It was like, oh. Hello.
You can, in those words, you can hear the cock of the neck and the swing of the bang.
Just the slight flick of the bang. Just, oh, hello. And it's just like, yes, you may take me. Thank you. But build up, let down. But it's usually written into the story, I find.
But back to Key Largo.
Yes.
Many, many films have taken the template of Key Largo, or I suppose the play that it's based on, of a bunch of characters who are at each other's throats, locked in a location together.
Especially when, like, one of them has a gun and is, like, holding everyone hostage.
A big,
long hostage crisis.
And they're usually big ensemble pieces. There's a lot of eccentric characters. Anything from, what was it called? Bad Luck at the the El Royale.
Bad Times at the El Royale.
Bad Times at the El Royale.
That's a good example.
Heck, the Tales from the Crypt movie, Demon Knight, is kind of a key Larder.
I would say Reservoir Dogs is very much in the same pattern.
Not to comment too extensively on the works of Quentin Tarantino. He is my boss.
But structurally, it's about a bunch of dudes trapped in a place, and there are a bunch of criminals, and there's a lot of
other films of his as well follow that same. I think The Hateful Eight more.
Hateful Eight's even better example. Yeah.
What I appreciate about Key Largo is that, and ordinarily this would be a detriment, but in this case it really works because the character work is so strong and the tension is so thick. The heroes, the ones being held hostage, don't have a plan.
Yeah.
There's not like, we just need to get a key out of a guy's pocket and we can unlock something and escape. Like, there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
They don't have any recourse here. And even if they were able to flee the building, they'd go out into a hurricane. So, and there's not even a plan to sort of wait it out and they'll be let go.
Yeah.
I think they kind of know that at the end of this, they're going to be murdered.
Probably going to be murdered.
This leaves, the characters, I think this license to just fuck with the bad guys.
This is what Humphrey Bogart decides to do over the course of this thing, because he knows this isn't something where it's like, okay, well, we might outnumber them, or maybe it's even odds, but they have a gun. Mm. It's okay. We'll take the gun. We'll like karate kick him in the face.
Yeah.
You know, like, or we'll do what Michael Myers does in Halloween Kills, and just constantly just like slap the gun away until they shoot each other. It's not like that. And I actually miss the way that like gunplay used to be done in movies, where it was a little less cool and romanticized, where it was basically like, okay, so who's in charge? Well, I have a gun. Oh, so I guess you're in charge. Hmm. Please don't shoot us. I might. Okay, well, I guess I'll just stay over here and hope for the best.
I don't know a lot about guns, so I can't talk to like the evolution of gun technology, if they've gotten lighter or heavier. There's less kick in your hand when the bullet explodes. In older movies, they seem to be more like cannons.
I think people just... a gun is... In a lot of older movies, it's almost like you have the Infinity Gauntlet. Like, you're not supposed to have that. It's almost cheating to have a gun. So if you've got a gun, especially if you've got, like, a big gun, like a Tommy gun or something like that, or a shotgun, you're in charge now, and please don't kill us, is the kind of vibe. And Humphrey Bogart may be a tough guy, but he also knows that those guys have a couple of guns.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do a goddamn thing because I'll probably get shot. It's close quarters. They don't even have to be a good shot to hit me. Mm. And if they miss me, they might hit Lauren Bacall or Lionel Barrymore, and I don't want that either. Or even Claire Trevor. She seems relatively cool. So Humphrey Bogart is in no position whatsoever to strong-arm anybody. It ultimately does end in a shootout, but in a very clever shootout. Mm. For most of the movie, all Humphrey Bogart can do is talk specifically to Johnny Rocco. Because the other guys are idiots. Johnny Rocco is smart, but he quickly realizes that because of that big entrance, because of that dramatic, over-the-top persona that Johnny Rocco has, because of Johnny Rocco's ego,
And his desperation. He's at the end of his rope.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the power he wants.
No. He was kicked out of America for all of his various, you know, organized crime schemes, and he's been trying to work his way back in ever since. He's got a big name. But this is his gang, like three dudes in an island in the Florida Keys. He is not a big wheel anymore, but he is dangerous.
Because of that desperation.
Because of that desperation, because, again, he's got a gun, they don't. So all Humphrey Bogart can do is play with that desperation and play with his insecurity.
Which he has a lot of, as it turns out.
And he does the smart thing where initially, when he meets Johnny Rocco, he's heard of him. He's read the newspaper. Mm. And he talks about how amazing Johnny Rocco is. So Johnny Rocco is lulled into like this false sense of security. They're like, this guy isn't going to fuck with me. Mm. But then throughout the rest of the movie, it's Humphrey Bogart subtly needling Johnny Rocco over and over again until Johnny Rocco no longer has the confidence needs to even... There's a scene where he decides Lauren Bacall spits in his face. He's been constantly whispering things to her, and we never hear what they are, so you know that they would go against the production code. You know that they are horrible, horrible things. And she spits in his face, and he's going to kill her. And Humphrey Bogart says, yeah, yeah, you could totally kill her. But of course you won't, because you're too smart for that. Mm. And Harry Thomas is like, meh. And then Humphrey Bogart's like, well, yeah, you know, if you kill her, you just have to kill all of us, including your own men, because we all saw you commit a crime, and you can't do that at this stage in your career. You can't go to jail for murder now. What would be the point? So you can only do it, like, when you could get away with it, and you can't do that right now. And your opponent's like, meh. Because well, it isn't even great logic. It makes no sense. His men know he's a murderer. Like, he could totally do it. But he's spoken to with such reverence. You know? Mm. It's like he just got Iago'd out of killing Lauren Bacall. Like, he just got completely connived.
And I think we should also add to that the Lionel Barrymore's attitude. Lionel Barrymore is disgusted by Johnny Rocco and what he represents. He
doesn't, moral outrage. Yeah, just start to finish.
Disgusted that by the fact that he's still alive. He even has a line like, "You shouldn't have been deported. We should have exterminated you."
Yeah,
and
which is a pretty hard line to take on crime, if you ask me.
Hard line, but I think, like, if it were just Lionel Barrymore, this, like, angry old man who was, like, hurling insults at him, he would have thrown him in the water and left him for dead.
Yeah.
But because his insecurities are on the rise, and because Humphrey Bogart is sort of needling him, those comments from Lionel Barrymore are actually hitting home a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he's insulting him, and he's actually, like, taken aback. The Edward Gene Robinson character is so great.
And
that he has all of the power in this scenario in terms of controlling other people.
He's genuinely threatening. He's truly scary.
And yet he is the most pathetic thing you've ever seen.
I love that. I love that in a villain. I love that in a villain. We do not do that enough in a villain. We sometimes assume that if you make a villain sympathetic, they must become likable. No, you don't have to do that. You can I understand where Johnny Rocco is coming from. I get his mentality. I do find him a little pitiable. I also think at the end of the movie, he gets what he deserves. You know? And I also think at the same time, it's like, okay, I pity him. I'm also terrified of him. Mm. That makes him dangerous.
He's,
you know?
He's both pitiable and pitiful. And I think that's it's such a wonderful way to play a villain.
There aren't enough like that, if you ask me.
Well, especially not these days. Me talking all the problems these days. But
actually, I think, was the first couple of movies anyway, was Kylo Ren.
A little bit.
Kylo Ren was pretty pathetic, but he was also extremely dangerous because of that.
Yeah, and they made him too sympathetic by that third
one,
film.
The third one that they went full hardcore redemption, and I'm like, a little too far.
I don't like the current trend in villain writing,
mm-hmm.
where they're either just not interesting. Yeah. They're just like killer monsters with an agenda,
right.
and have no personality. Something like Justice League, the bad guys in Justice League,
yeah, just
gray
bad
CGI
guys.
Monsters.
Yeah,
or they are given so much sympathy that the excitement of their villainy is now gone.
Yeah, and now we just want to see them. We just want to we want to change them.
Yeah,
like he's Loki. He's bad, but I could change him. Give him his own series.
And now he has his own series, and he's this sympathetic figure.
And that's fun. Like, but you do that every single time, it gets pretty old. They did it with Baron Zemo, and yada yada yada.
They do it in all of the live action remakes of the Disney animated films.
Yeah,
films that originally were kind of had notable, interesting villains because of their monstrous villainy.
Yeah, let's take the puppy skinning villain from Disney canon and make them a heroic.
She's like, some
anti-hero in the punk scene.
Yeah, and
who really loves
she's some
dogs.
Sort of wild bohemian rather than, a dog murderer.
And she really loves dogs, and she would never hurt a dog. And at the end, she gives the two dogs from 101 Dalmatians to their owners so that they could fall in love. And so the dogs could fall in love. Those dogs were related.
Those dogs are from the same litter.
Yeah. So that adds a weird element.
The 101 Dalmatians are
well,
the result of dog incest.
Well, to be fair, we had a lot of Dalmatians when I was growing up. We would adopt Dalmatians are a commonly inbred.
Yeah.
And which is why a lot of Dalmatians are born deaf.
Mm.
We had a deaf dog growing up.
That's
it's a very
true
sweet
of a lot of purebred dogs.
Yeah.
That in order to keep the breed pure, they would inbreed the dogs.
So that's a weird tangent. I didn't think we would go on tonight.
No, why are we talking about dog inbreeding when we're talking about Key Largo? The climax of Key Largo totally ripped off Mitchell. there's my first exposure to a film called Key Largo was, as with many of many pieces of my pop culture education, was a riff from Mystery Science Theater. Tom Servo, God, while watching the film Mitchell starring Joe Don Baker, shouted, "Let's rip off the climax from Key Largo, Mitchell," and it took place on a boat.
Yeah.
The climax of Key Largo, all of the gangsters get on a boat with Humphrey Bogart, who's like their insurance policy.
Well, he's the only one who knows boats. Mm. And they take him with them, and there's a great bit where it's a really great bit, actually, where Claire Trevor, who we kind of skipped over the best bit of Claire Trevor,
opened with her.
Well, yeah. We opened with her, but we didn't really delve. We had to talk about the plot, and we never came back. Claire Trevor was Rocco's girlfriend for many, many years, and he's been mistreated this whole time. And she's been driven to drink, she's been driven to gambling. And there's a scene in the movie where Rocco, like, tells her to sing for everybody, and she doesn't want to, and she's out of practice. And
I was watching this with the subtitles on,
uh-huh,
and her singing is described as mediocre singing in brackets.
She's okay. She can carry a tune, but she's clearly not in her element.
It's a wonderful performance because it takes a really talented actor to play somebody who's not good at something.
Well, the irony is that John Huston directed this, and he basically told Claire Trevor to do it without ever rehearsing it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She didn't want to, actually. She was a little uncomfortable with it. Apparently, it wasn't cool. But regardless, it did get a good performance. I've never been a fan of that kind of... Too often we've romanticized that kind of emotional manipulation. But
I think it's not cool that she wasn't okay with it.
Yeah,
but exactly. if she said she wasn't okay with it, he should have explained... I needed this character to sound unrehearsed.
Could be so simple. Just
explain that afterwards. Just do that.
Or before. They get it. Anyway, they're an actor. They'll act. She gives this incredibly, like, heartbreaking, like, not skilled performance performing this song. And at the end, Johnny Rocco, she looks at Johnny Rocco for some kind of nourishment. Some kind of validation, care. Some kind of love or care, and he just throws it right back at her that she is like just sad and done, and that's the last straw for her. So in the end, when he says to Humphrey Bogart, "You're coming with us," she slips him a gun, and they expect him. They say like, "Use the gun when they get into the boat, run away, take a break for it, just do it." Everyone's just like, "Just do it. We hate this guy," but Humphrey Bogart. We watch him in real time. There's no it was editing, but it takes place over as long amount of time as it would take of him like leaving the hotel and like going to the boat and then the boat going away. And they're all just watching him like, why isn't he doing anything? Why isn't he doing anything? Like what? That was his chance. And like, was he paralyzed by fear? Did he decide that he's going to try to steal the money? What is he going to do? And it's like, no, he's taking them away from like potential victims and collateral damage. And he's putting them in a situation where he has all the power. You know, it's like hijacking someone who's driving the car.
Yeah.
But you can't shoot them now. They're driving the car. You can fall off. You can fly off the road. And of course, it all leads to Humphrey Bogart taking an opportunity to like throw people in the water, shoot people, and then like climb on top of the boat and then like wait for Edward G. Robinson. Edward G. Robinson has no idea what just happened out there. He just heard gunshots. So he's just talking to Humphrey Bogart. Humphrey Bogart could be dead. He has no idea. But he keeps talking to him. And he keeps like just giving more and more and more and throwing out the money. And yeah, Humphrey Bogart just shoots the shit out of him. And good. Johnny Rocco is a really evil man.
Yeah.
I don't condone violence of any kind, but it's a movie. And I think this one feels like fate to me. You know,
Johnny Rocco killed a guy. We didn't mention that he did kill a guy and left. They dropped him out in the ocean. He ended up washing back to shore.
The
cops got involved for a bit. So like things kept on mounting as the film went on.
They're like a pair of like escaped fugitives who didn't even do anything that bad, but the cops are looking for them, and like their whole family is like trying to get into the hotel in the middle of the hurricane, and Johnny Rocco doesn't let him in, and he's a bad guy.
He's a bad guy. He's a sad guy, and. Yeah. there's a logic to his end. Mm-hmm. This is not a man who is destined to climb his way back into the criminal underworld.
This is not a second act for this guy.
This
is not a man who's going to die like an old man in his bed surrounded by his loved ones and admirers.
No, so this is...
this guy's going to die really bad someday.
There's not going to be a Key Largo 2 where we catch up with Edward G. Robinson having become successful again. No, we understand where this guy is going. There is a sort of fatalism to a lot of film noir. We understand somebody has to be executed by the end in order to maintain a weird kind of moral balance to the universe.
Well, and you can't let the guy just run around and do whatever.
Right.
Something's got to happen. Yeah.
And because there are there's no heroes and there's no justice in the world of film noir, it has to be vigilante justice in order to take him out, or some sort of ironic end brought about by his own hubris.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of both.
And yeah, what I like about the climax is it's Humphrey Bogart is stalking around the boat with a gun and he's firing bullets into people. But Edward G. Robinson is also shooting people.
Yeah.
He's like shooting the other guys on the boat.
The guy's like, well, why don't you go out there and investigate? It's like, well, Humphrey Bogart might be out there with a gun. All right. Bang. Oh, right. Yeah. You're dead now. Shit.
I think there's four thugs on the boat and they each shoot two of them and until they're down to like just the last two.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And it's just like Martin Balsam and Jodan Baker on the boat at the end of Mitchell.
You're right. That does make it better.
It's really powerful. It really is just identical. It's like powerful. I was so astonished. Like there are those weird moments where your pop culture map is filled in a little bit more, where you finally find the inspiration for something.
I didn't know that was where from that comes something, from. Yeah. And now I realize that was a ripoff.
I saw a film that used the phrase "Hasta la vista, baby," and it was made before Terminator 2.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
I mean, that was just an expression, but like, regardless, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you want to shine someone on.
Well, that's speaking of shining, I remember when I finally saw The Bridge on the River Kwai, and they actually used the phrase, like, all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. And I had never heard that from like something earlier than The Shining. I knew it was an expression, but I'd never actually seen it in pop culture, like, used anywhere. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
I get it. Or I finally understood the whole Spaceballs joke. Dink, dink. Dink, 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 dink.
Oh, the because that's the
whistles.
I forgot the name of that tune, but yeah, that was also used in Bridge on the River Kwai.
The soldiers whistle that as they march around. Yeah.
But yeah, when it was this weird pop culture synchronicity when I finally watched Key Largo, because this was my first time watching it.
Same.
And how it linked up to this really shitty cop movie from the 70s with Jodan Baker. It's like, wait a minute, this thing is actually way more, it's so influential, like it leaked down into like these really awful B-cop movies.
Well, I stand by that this actually is definitely in the DNA of something like Die Hard. You know, every hostage movie, I mean, I'm sure there were other hostage stories before this. I could probably think of a few if I really rack my brain, but this kind of just one guy is in control, everyone else is just, and it's the whole movie, it's not just one sequence. The whole movie is just, how do we get out of the situation where one guy is taking us hostage, and it's a situation that we cannot flee. And then just add Bruce Willis in there, and it took us about 40 years, but we finally nailed that formula. Key Largo is cool.
Key Largo in a building.
Yeah, John,
that was the pitch for Die Hard.
Yeah. Key Largo rocks.
I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
it's because it's not just a really taut thriller, but it works really well because of all the character reasons.
It's interesting. We recently reviewed on our Oscars podcast and our Patreon, The Maltese Falcon, which is John Huston's first directorial effort, which is also a very hard boiled movie. It also starred Humphrey Bogart, and you didn't care for it that much.
Not so much.
Which is fine. Yeah. I just think it's because John Huston had like this long career of like really examining tough guys and tough guy situations, whether it was sincere or a bit ironic. And I think it's interesting that this one is actually almost a lot more straightforward than The Maltese Falcon. I feel like The Maltese Falcon is very teasing motion picture. It's more playful in a lot of ways.
I think what I don't like about The Maltese Falcon in comparison to Key Largo is that the Humphrey Bogart character in The Maltese Falcon is always the one who has sort of the upper hand. He's always in control. He's the one manipulating the other characters, and he also doesn't care. There's a lot of nihilism to it. And he actually has no stake as to whether or not who gets the Falcon at the end.
Yeah.
In this one, he is not the aggressor.
Yeah.
Edward G. Robinson is the aggressor. But Edward, as we've mentioned, Edward G. Robinson is so such a pathetic figure that it's only up to Humphrey Bogart to sort of gain the upper hand emotionally, even if he doesn't have the gun in his hand. And I think that dynamic is really interesting.
Yeah.
There's no one to challenge Humphrey Bogart in the Maltese Falcon. There's nothing to sort of make me understand what he's doing as kind of impressive or exhilarating.
I think it's interesting because I look at the Maltese Falcon and maybe a little bit more meta than you do, where everyone else is super invested in everything that's going on, and Humphrey Bogart is the person from outside of people and their obsessions going, the fuck are you doing? You know, I think it is about obsession. And I think his one step removed from that gives it an element of meta humor, a little bit of subversiveness compared to a lot of other similar films.
When we referred to it, I compared it to, of all things, The Big Lebowski, which is another detective story about a detective who really can't be bothered and is kind of outside of everything and doesn't really. The interesting thing about The Big Lebowski, A, it's a comedy film, and B, he's such an outsider, he doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah, well, he's not a detective. He's treated like one, but he's never actually asked to be one.
That's the joke. Like, he's asked to be a detective and do detective stuff, but he's, like, the opposite of a detective. He's just this guy in a sweater.
Completely incurious about the entire world.
He drinks booze and he bowls, and that's his entire world. Can you be a detective? Sure, man. I don't like. It's like
the one time in that movie he actually tries.
Tommy Chong as Sam Spade.
There's one time in that movie, in The Big Lebowski, where he actually like tries to be a detective. He tries to do like one cool thing.
The rubbing on the pad of paper.
Someone answers the phone and like writes something on a pad of paper and then pulls off the top thing. And if you've ever like seen someone do that, you know, you can take a pencil.
If you've read Encyclopedia Brown, they'll teach you.
You can take a pencil and just lightly rub over the bottom sheet of paper and you can see
the imprint.
Yeah, there's an indentation from the top sheet. And he's like, oh, okay, I finally got it. I could get a clue here. And the guy just doodled a dirty drawing. That's all it is.
It's a doodle of a naked man that he doodled and put it in his pocket.
Yeah, it's like nothing.
And of course, he finds that rubbing and it's just this dirty picture. And he also keeps the dirty picture rubbing, which a cop finds in his pocket later and just sort of looks at it. It's just a good, funny moment. I do like The Big Lebowski. I'm not one of the cultists, but I really love the movie.
You don't have to be a cultist to love that movie.
But something about the Maltese Falcon, with its lack of humor and with its lack of a figure to for the Humphrey Bogart character to really kind of bounce off of, he's just sort of looking at all the other characters squabbling over something he doesn't care about, made it unengaging to me.
The only thing that I can appreciate that take, but the one thing I don't understand about what you just said is the lack of humor. I think that movie's very funny.
Oh, well.
I think we're just looking at it through very different lenses, but anyway.
Maybe so.
But at least we agree on Key Largo. Key Largo is pretty cool.
I like Key Largo a lot.
Yeah, you might. The one thing I would say is if you watch Key Largo and you haven't seen it like before we did this, and you go to watch it, it's been riffed on and copied or just used as a piece of so many other stories and movies ever since that this might be a little straightforward. Mm. And it might you might ask yourself, maybe there should be more incident in here. But you got to remember that like before there were all these movies that took this one idea and then just kept adding new stuff to it to make it exciting. Mm. There was one exciting idea in the first place. And that's pretty much this. There's not a lot of fat on this movie. It's very efficient. It's basically, we're stuck in a hotel with gangsters. Why can't we leave? There's a hurricane. That's it. That's the whole fucking movie. And that's all you need. Especially when the cast is this good. Especially Edward G. Robinson. He's amazing. I'm amazed he wasn't nominated. Humphrey Bogart's very, very good. Lauren Bacall is very, very good. A somewhat underwritten role, if you ask me. I wish he'd had a little bit more to do. But Lionel Barrymore is fantastic. Claire Trevor totally deserved that Oscar.
It's actually really unusual that Lauren Bacall is kind of the least interesting character.
Yeah.
Or I guess maybe not the least interesting, but like has the least character of all these kind of over-the-top figures that she's around. She's a little bit more down-to-earth and human.
But she really captivates the screen, almost everything I've ever seen her in. And
She feels like Marilyn Munster. Like, everybody around her is this weird monster, and she's like the little bit more clean-cut, down-to-earth character.
Here's what she's got. Unassailable dignity.
That's true.
And unlike her father, who feels
she's
the
not
need
getting
to, like,
pushed around a bunch.
Her father is this incredible emotional vulnerability that requires him to sort of latch on to this guy who is part of his son's life and treat him like a son. To be nice to everybody he meets, and to, when you see someone who represents the exact opposite of that ideology, to respond to him virulently, you know, as if, you know, like a snake had just bit him. Lauren Bacall is just has that. She doesn't need all of that extra baggage with it. She's great. I feel like the role is just not as juicy as some of the other stuff in the film. But regardless, yeah, Key Largo. Key Largo rocks. Thank you, everybody who voted for Key Largo.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed watching. If you watched it before the show, if you watched it after the show, well, you know how it ends. But it's still really good, and you should totally see it. Next time on Critically Reclaimed, we are going to head on over to Netflix. We haven't been to Netflix in a while. And we're going to look at their family section. Whitney and I have each picked two films apiece that one or both of us have not seen. Won't tell you which one's which. We are going to let our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork vote for the film they want us to review on the next Critically Reclaimed. And your options are, in no particular order, the remake of The Karate Kid, the one with Jackie Chan and Jaden Smith, where he doesn't learn karate.
he learns kung fu, if I recall.
Yeah. Weird, but all right. Beethoven, the one about the family that gets a really big dog, and it's a really big dog, and that's the film.
The dog movie,
also with Charles Grodin. We brought Charles Grodin back in, so
oh,
there
yeah.
you go. Good Burger, the film based on a Nickelodeon sketch comedy show about a couple of doofuses who work in a small time burger joint with a fancy burger joint across the street. It's used cars, but with burgers and very
'90s
humor.
And kid friendly. And
yeah.
Abe Vigoda is in it.
Abe Vigoda is in that film, ladies and gentlemen. And it's got Keenan and Kel, and it's got a cult following. And then lastly, the Spiderwick Chronicles, which are about the various adventures, chronicles, if you will, of a spider who makes candles.
No, that's not what it's about.
Makes a spider who makes candles.
It's about a young boy who moves out to a remote mansion, and there's like magical critters living around it.
And there's a spider who previously was an assassin for the Russian mafia quit. But then they killed its pet spider, and he came back to kill everybody.
The bad guy is a monster. I believe it's an ogre, and it's played by Nick Nolte.
I was going for like a John Wick reference, but you just kind of...
Yeah, well, the Spiderwick Chronicles came up in that gigantic wave of YA fantasy fiction in the wake of the popularity of Harry Potter.
Yeah, it turns out there was only room for like 2.5 of those franchises to actually make a lot of money, but everyone tried. Anyway, so those are all the options. Vote for whichever one you want us to review for whatever reason you see fit. Maybe you think it's good. Maybe you think it'll be bad. Maybe you just picked one at random. I don't care. Vote. Please vote. That's it for Critically Reclaimed. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Head on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you want to talk about anything we discussed on this episode, there's a couple of ways to do that. We're on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I am @WhitneySeibel.
We also have an email podcast called We've Got Mail, where we read our emails. You can write in, talk about anything we discussed here. Anything at all you want to talk about, really. It doesn't have to be about this podcast. And our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we also have a P.O. box for people who like to write physical letters or send us stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whitney, what is that P.O. box?
Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Darn tootin'. And that's about it. So thank you, everybody. You have a great weekend. And never forget, this was the Critically Reclaimed podcast.
Well done.